This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina is home to the largest military installation in the world by population. Fort Bragg employs more than 50,000 military employees and close to 30,000 civilians. And the base has a long and storied history. First built in 1918 as an artillery training ground, then expanded rapidly during World War II, later became home to the 82nd Airborne Division and the U.S. Army Special Forces, or Green Beret. Fort Bragg turns 100 next year, and WUNC has partnered with the Fayetteville Observer and the American Homefront Project to collect first-person accounts of life on and around the post from the past, that past century. Joining me now is Elizabeth Friend. She's a radio producer, and she is working on the Fort Bragg Stories Project. Elizabeth, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
Also with us is Tom McCollum. He is a Fayetteville native. He spent the bulk of his military and civilian career in Fort Bragg and is now a public affairs officer at the base. Tom, welcome.
Good welcome. Thank you.
So tell us more. Give us the sketch, the brief history of this base. 1918, when and why, well, we know where it was built, but why?
Sure. If you go back in time, you look at it, World War I was being waged in Europe. The United States had not entered, and then, but we had an idea that we needed to start getting ready. And most of our installations and our were out of date, especially for modern warfare. And one of the areas that they really needed, a large area, was field artillery. And they wanted to locate a new field artillery base on the East Coast with, that also had railheads to it. And the group that was going around looking, they were told about the Fayetteville area and what was north of it. They went on out. They checked out the area. They were thrilled with what they saw because of the railheads in Fayetteville in the area. And then the large expansions of land, the soft sand that would help with the impacts of the rounds, and the vast quantities of land that they could buy. And they decided Fort Bragg, or then Camp Bragg, was going to be established. And it started in September of 1918.
And the war ended shortly thereafter, World War One.
Yeah, in September of 1918, we were established. And November of 1918, it ended. And February of 1919, construction on the first phase of Fort Bragg ended. So it was over before we had a chance to fully stand up.
Was there a thought that they might the base might be closed at that point?
Yeah, not at that point, but a few years later, in the 1920s, just like BRAC, the Army started looking at, and Department of then War was looking at, well, what can we cut back in? And Fort Bragg was on the chopping block. And there was a large effort done by the Chamber of Commerce in the Fayetteville area, the state of North Carolina, and the Army itself going back saying, look, you cannot replicate what is out here on the East Coast. We need a base of this size for field artillery. And it was they came across and they ended up agreeing, and we went from Fort Bragg to Camp. Let's try it again. From Camp Bragg to Fort Bragg.
So it gets a little bit bigger, and does it stay mostly that size until World War II, or is it slowly growing between that period, between the wars?
We basically stayed about the same size. And just prior to World War II, an area known as Camp McCall was stood up, and that's south of Aberdeen. And that is where actually the home of the airborne was during World War II. Though we did have the 82nd and the 101st at Fort Bragg, but we also had the 9th Infantry Division and a lot of other basic units there. We went from about 5,600 soldiers in around early 1941 to over 60,000 by the end of the year.
Wow.
And maxed out at over 110,000.
I mean, that must have been quite a period. I can imagine these recruits and soldiers coming in and not even having places to go. You're building while they're showing up, right?
Oh, you bet. There are stories of people living in as far away as Sanford in barns and in garages because there was just not enough housing in the area. And we had a whole army, if you will, of workers building Fort Bragg as everyone was coming in. There's photos of construction crews where trains are coming in loaded down with lumber, and the crews would just offload the lumber at the site from the trains and then start construction. And as I understand, they had it down so well in 30 minutes they could have your stereotypical two-story World War II wooden barracks built.
And, of course, they were meant to be temporary, and I guess some of them are still there, aren't they?
Yeah, we still have some. Oddly enough, we don't have the money to tear them down.
Hey, later, so it becomes home. You talked about the 82nd Airborne and the Army Special Forces. Tell us about the significance of that, them being stationed there.
Sure. What happened in the 82nd ended up being deactivated after World War II, but then was reactivated and brought back. And it was decided Fort Bragg was going to be its home. In World War II, there was you had the guys going in, training the French resistance and mm-hmm. linking up with them. And they ended up going, they were based at Fort Bragg, but it wasn't Special Forces at that time. And the OSS was basically their organization. And then in 1953, or 52, excuse me, mm-hmm. Special Forces was stood up. And that is where, because of the PSYOPs operations that were based there.
Psychological operations?
Yes. Yeah. They were able to work side by side, and Special Forces has since been very live and well and extremely active.
Elizabeth Friend, tell us about this project now, the Fort Bragg Stories Project. What are you aiming to do?
Well, this is, as you said, a joint collaboration to try and commemorate those 100 years of history. But rather than just laying it out in a chronological timeline, we thought that maybe we could bring this history to life through personal stories. And so less of an emphasis on war stories, although that's certainly part of it, but also more of a focus on people's lives, their day-to-day experience at Fort Bragg.
Over that time. And, of course, much of the experience is around the fact that, at least for paratroopers, you are on 18-hour notice. You have to be ready to deploy in 18 hours, Tom. This is a big part of the story, at least for many who are stationed at Fort Bragg.
Sure. Fort Bragg is home of the Rapid Deployment Force, and it is 18 hours of notification. We're able to kick a unit out. Years ago, I was involved in one of those deployments, and it moves like clockwork. The aircraft come in, everyone loads up, and we're gone and on our way. But we also at Fort Bragg have a lot of units and a lot of soldiers that go before the 18-hour notification. And so Fort Bragg is basically one of the first to deploy and usually one of the last to come home.
Elizabeth, in fact, you have a clip to share with us about someone who experienced that clip, that quick deployment, right? Tell us about
That's
it.
That's right. This is a clip from Bill Wadford. He was working as a nurse at the Womack Army Hospital on a night shift in December 1989 when he got the call to deploy to Panama.
Around 10 o'clock, the phone in the hallway rang. We were in the process of doing an emergency C-section. The baby was out. The mom was stable. We were closing. And I had time, so I went out and I answered the phone. And it was our executive officer, the 5th MASH. His voice was quite tense. And he goes, Captain Wadford, very formal. Captain Wadford, you are ordered to immediately report to the warehouse where the FST is preparing in case we have to move out. I said, Billy, we're right in the middle of an operation right now. I can't leave. He goes, I repeat the order.
Veteran Bill Wadford, who recorded his story as part of the Fort Bragg Stories Project. I'm here with project producer Elizabeth Friend and participant Tom McCollum, who is the public affairs officer at the base. What else did he tell you?
Well, he went from that operating room to a surgical tent at the end of a runway in Panama for the Panama invasion. And even though it's one of the shortest military conflicts in American history, it feels really long if you are awake for 70 hours operating on combat wounded in a tent. And so he talked at length about how in that moment there's no real time to mourn or process what's going on, and that the process of working through that grief and that loss can sometimes take decades.
What other kinds of stories are you hearing?
We've got a really wide range, and I love that they span the decades as they do. I talked to a man named Billy Herring who grew up on the base in the 40s. His dad ran the dairy. And he recalls vividly that they would use mules to move the artillery around. And the mules were so important to the training and to the war effort that they slept in concrete barns while the men were sleeping in tents. And he was told that if you mistreated your mule, you had to walk around for the next day wearing a saddle as punishment. So nobody messed with the mules.
And the dairy suggests that a lot of local farmers were providing for the base at that point.
So from that slice of life from World War II all the way up to the present day, I've talked to folks who lived in the community or on base during 9/11, and how that was such a dramatic change because it went from an open base where you could essentially walk on and walk around to closed and gated. And some people saw that very strikingly as a symbol of some of the innocence that had been lost at that time. Other people found it deeply alienating, and they had a hard time figuring out how they fit into that community after that.
Well, joining our conversation now is Master Sergeant Judy Espinosa Betancourt. She works in the Department of Preventive Medicine on Fort Bragg and will be sharing her story at a Fort Bragg Stories live storytelling event this Saturday in Fayetteville. Sergeant Betancourt, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, thank you so very much for the opportunity.
You say that from a young age you knew you wanted to be in the military. Tell us about that.
Yes, I've always been a warrior at heart, and so I knew I came from a very diverse background. My father is from Peru, and my mother is from the United States, obviously. And, you know, there's some ideologies out there. He thought maybe I should be a teacher or a nurse, and I really wasn't feeling that. I wanted to serve my country. I was a warrior, always. Came out of my mother's womb, you know, fighting because I almost died, unfortunately. But the point is that I've always had that drive and that tenacity and perseverance, and I knew there was something more out there for me. And so I joined the Army in 1993, to be exact.
You're working in preventive medicine now. Tell us more about what you do on the base.
Well, this is my second rotation here to, as you have defined, the center of the universe. And now I am presently, as you verbalized, the NCOIC of Department of Preventive Medicine. And preventive medicine is a specialty MOS that focuses on the health of the individual service members, the community, and that defined population. The essential goal is to protect, promote, and maintain health and well-being to prevent disease and disability and death. So we prevent by education and inspection of water sources, food sources. We do surveys to see if there are any insects out there that can cause disease. And we want to make sure that our service members, when they're in a deployed environment, they're protected.
You also, you have a son now who's 14 years old, and the story that you're going to be telling this weekend is about your experience being a mother in the military. Can you give us a preview?
Yes, absolutely. Being a female warrior, I'm also a non-traditional mother, to say the least. And he's 14. He presently lives with his father in Fort Benning, Georgia. And I have not really been able to live with him as a traditional mother because I've been on deployments. I've been an AIT platoon sergeant. I've been going nonstop. And so my story will basically depict it, my experience of having to leave my child with my good family, my family, their great support, and my desire to still choose to be in the Army and take care of my other soldiers out there and make sure that they have the tools and the leadership and the mentorship to take my place one day as I will one day transition out of the Army by retiring. So there, I have a loyalty, of course, to my child, but I also have a good family support group, and they can take care of him as I'm on this wonderful adventure as a master sergeant serving in our country.
What does it mean to you to be telling your story publicly like this?
Well, you know, I have a strong loyalty to all my brother and sister in arms, absolutely. However, what I really want to identify, and a lot of my female warrior comrades out there will be able to relate, that though, you know, there are a lot of female warriors out there that perhaps struggle with the fact that they're leaving their child, you know, and how do they deal with that struggle? How do they deal with the resiliency and the balance of their loyalty to not only their team, their soldiers, the Army as a whole? How do they deal with that resiliency? And to let other females maybe to get some validation from that, because we do play an important role in the mission, and we are in combat, and we do defend our comrades out there. But as a non-traditional mother, that is it's a struggle. It's a struggle to leave your child, but letting them know there's other perspectives in the Army. It's not just about kicking down doors or killing the enemy. There's other perspectives, and perhaps this is a new perspective that the audience can, you know, I understand. You know, I never looked at it from that perspective idea.
Well, Tom McCollum, a public affairs officer at Fort Bragg, the project is looking at a century of Fort Bragg, 1918. Of course, that was a year of monument building in the South, a return to white supremacy. And the fact is that Fort Bragg is named for a Confederate soldier. How do you all work with that? Confederate general, in fact.
That's a misnomer. It's not named after his time in service in the Confederacy. It was named after Braxton Bragg, who was a North Carolina native, and that was the main focus. But during the Mexican-American War, evidently he did a lot of great things as an artillery commander. And he was recognized for that. to the point where a lot of his soldiers in the past, they really looked up to him. And he had a legend at that time. And there are two, because of that, the loyalty they faced towards him. Now, there are two other Fort Braggs in the United States well before we ever showed up, and it was named because of their service with him.
Now, he did, in these times, as we're becoming more sensitive to this kind of thing, you're talking about a Confederate soldier who fought against American soldiers and who declared that he was not an American anymore, by definition. Is this time to revisit this question, given now the sensitivity, whatever the reason for naming him originally, the fact is he was a Confederate soldier, time to revisit the name of the fort?
My personal opinion, or in reality,
I'm not
quite sure, to tell you the truth, because when you... The good thing about having Fort Bragg named after him is it's out in the open. People can talk about who he was, what did he represent at that time period, and so you have to have that. You can't bring all that stuff into a closed building, such as a museum. You have to have it out in the public. But the one thing I really want to stress is the history of Fort Bragg is not Braxton Bragg. That's who we were named after. The history of Fort Bragg, and especially that's being shown during this presentation, is the millions of soldiers that have come from throughout the country and their families who have served at Fort Bragg, what did they contribute to this nation? And one of the goals I really hope comes out of this is people who are not associated with the military find out these people are just like me.
And in some ways, even more representative of the world at large. It's a diverse population that it brings to Fayetteville and the state of North Carolina.
Oh, big time. You can look back at the weddings of the soldiers, those from the 1950s. A lot of them were European and brought back European and German wives, especially. In the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of Southeast Asian wives brought in. In the 70s and early 80s, it was South American and Central American. And it is just constantly repeating, and that has made Fayetteville a very diverse and rich community. And that the soldiers and their families, what they bring is the true treasure to North Carolina.
Elizabeth Friend, tell us more about this weekend's event in Fayetteville.
Well, this is a live storytelling event. We have done a round of interviews with our participants and selected a handful to showcase at this event. And basically, these are folks who are going to tell stories about human connections that are both strengthened by and challenged by the demands of military service.
And what about the project in general? It doesn't end here. You're still collecting stories, are you?
That's right. I see this really as a beginning. So we want to collect stories, online submissions that we'll host in a curated online archive throughout 2018. And then we're also collecting stories that we'll then turn into interviews to edit into StoryCorps style vignettes and also companion pieces in the Fayetteville Observer. And then a few folks are doing this live storytelling, which is just another really nice way to get these stories out there.
So how long will the collecting be going on?
Certainly through March and probably beyond that.
All right, and some of these are going to end up on the radio, and some will be archived, and others, of course, you'll have live. Will there be more live storytelling events, do you think?
I think that remains to be seen. I think we're going to find some really compelling stories as we move forward, and I would love to see another storytelling event.
Elizabeth Friend, a radio producer with the Fort Bragg Stories Project. Tom McCollum is Fayetteville native and a public affairs officer at Fort Bragg. Master Sergeant Judy Espinoza Betancourt works in the Department of Preventive Medicine on Fort Bragg. Tom and Judy will be telling more of their stories at Fort Bragg Stories Project. It's a live storytelling event this Saturday at the Airborne and Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville. And we've got all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, photojournalist who has documented the refugee crisis over more than a decade. We'll talk about that on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.